On November 1st, 2007, 12-year-old Jalik Rainwalker went to Red Robin in Latham, New York, with his adoptive father for dinner. The wait staff at Red Robin reported seeing Jalik at around 8 p.m. That was the last confirmed sighting of Jalik Rainwalker. 10 years later, we still don't know where he is. What if your loved one went missing? What if years and years went by and you couldn't find them?
It's an anniversary no one is celebrating. On November 1st, 2007, 12-year-old Jalik Rainwalker was reported missing by his adoptive father.
What would you do? How much would you give to get them back?
If I concentrate, I can still feel his arms around me. His grandmother has never stopped looking for Jalik.
The chief of the Cambridge Greenwich Police Department holds firm that no stone will be left unturned.
What if no one cared?
We should cover the country we have and not the country that we apparently imagine.
She holds out hope that one day there will be justice for Jalik.
This is Lee.
And this is Travis. We're the hosts of this podcast, and we thank you for listening. This podcast will be released on a weekly basis and will cover a new case each week. We are accepting case suggestions at missingminorityproject@gmail.com or through our Facebook page. You can also find us on Twitter at @MMP_podcast. We hope this podcast will help some of the missing persons who haven't received very much media attention. This episode covers the disappearance of Jalik Rainwalker. It is intensely sad, and fair warning, involves child abuse and neglect. We left out graphic details, but if that's a trigger for you, you may want to try another episode later. This podcast is intended for adult consumption. Listener discretion is advised.
Jalik went missing on November 2nd, 2007. Jalik is a biracial male of both African-American and Caucasian descent. He was 12 years old when he went missing, stood at 5'6", and weighed about 105 pounds. He has green eyes and brown hair. Jalik was born on August 2nd, 1995. Jalik's mother was a sex worker who used crack and alcohol while she was pregnant with him. And as a result, Jalik was born addicted to both substances. The state took Jalik from his mother, and he was placed in the foster care system. By the time he was a toddler, Jalik was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, as well as reactive attachment disorder. Reactive attachment disorder, or RAD, is an uncommon but severe disorder that affects children. RAD seems to develop in infancy or sometime before the child reaches the age of 5. The symptoms include unexplained withdrawal, fear, sadness, or irritability, a listless appearance, and sometimes not seeking comfort or showing no response when comfort is given. So how does RAD happen? Well, it typically occurs when there's attachment issues between a child and his or her primary caregiver. Those attachment issues typically happen when the caregiver was grossly negligent or because the child is bounced from caregiver to caregiver. Jalik lived in as many as 6 foster homes in his life, so that may have been a contributing factor to his RAD. Treatment of RAD usually involves intensive therapy, counseling, and parenting education. By all accounts, Jalik had some pretty severe symptoms of RAD. His former foster parents, Jody and Larry Schoon, described Jalik as intelligent, but very troubled. His violent outbursts could last upward of an hour. While Jalik was living with Jody and Larry, they had to send him to respite care a couple of times with 2 people called Tom and Elaine Persons. Remember their name because they will come up later in the story. Respite care is vital to full-time caregivers of children with special needs or emotional issues. Tom and Elaine were able to give Jody and Larry time to re-energize, and Jalik was given time to decompress in a safe environment. Jody and Larry had planned to adopt Jalik. However, after about 4 years of living with them, he attacked their 7-year-old daughter, and Jody and Larry decided he could no longer live in their home. I imagine this was heartbreaking for all involved, but particularly Jalik. When Jalik left Jody and Larry's home, he was fostered by a man called Stephen Kerr and his wife, Jocelyn McDonald. Stephen and Jocelyn already had 4 children, one that is biologically Jocelyn's from another relationship, 2 that Stephen and Jocelyn had together, and 1 adopted child who also had disabilities. After a couple of years, Stephen and Jocelyn decided to adopt Jalik. They received a hefty sum for having adopted 2 children with disabilities, roughly $36,000 a year of tax-free money. The money from the state helps parents who want to adopt disabled children but may not have the money to do so because of healthcare expenses. Stephen and Jocelyn led a non-traditional lifestyle. For instance, they gave the surname Rainwalker to all of their children. They lived in rustic Washington County, New York, in a 20-foot by 20-foot building with their 5 children, 2 dogs, 7 cats, and themselves. There was no running water in their house. The toilets were outhouses, and the electricity came from a generator, which only ran for a few hours during the day. The whole family slept in 1 room, and the children were homeschooled in a small setting at a neighbor's house. There is a picture of the house on our website. It doesn't appear to be in very good shape. I'm not sure why the state felt comfortable adopting children to Stephen and Jocelyn.
The family claimed they lived that way for environmental reasons, but I don't understand how anyone can find that acceptable. If you're a social worker, please reach out. We'd love to hear your expertise on the situation.
Jalik's life with Stephen and Jocelyn was not easy. He never adjusted to the way his adoptive parents lived. He and his adopted sister were treated differently than the other 3 who were biologically Stephen and Jocelyn's. Jalik and his adopted sister were required to do many more chores than their siblings. They had to go to bed at 6:30 p.m., while the other children were allowed to stay up, watch TV, and eat treats.
This angers me. If you take a child to your home, this is now your child, period. You treat all children the same. You do for one, you do for all.
Jalik was mistreated in other ways, too. The money Stephen and Jocelyn collected for adopting Jalik did not go to the medication or intensive therapy that he required. Jalik had violent outbursts, and allegedly his 4 siblings were afraid of him. Jalik's relationship with his parents was also volatile. He lived without medication or therapy for 5 years when the situation finally reached crisis levels. On October 22nd or 23rd, 2007, we've seen it reported as both dates, Jalik lashed out at a 4-year-old child in his homeschool group. The child was bothering Jalik, and Jalik told him to go away. He also issued a sexual threat against the 4-year-old. The 4-year-old's mother was reportedly unfazed by the situation, but Jocelyn was enraged. She told Stephen that she was done with Jalik and that she did not want to see him or even speak with him ever again. And sometime after that, Stephen called a crisis hotline claiming that Jalik was unmanageable, that Jocelyn was scared of him, and that they wanted to reverse the adoption. It is not clear whether Jalik knew that his parents wanted to reverse the adoption.
For his sake, let's hope he didn't. But by the way he was treated, I'm sure it's very clear to Jalik how they felt about him. Jalik's a 12-year-old boy who had been through a lot in his life at this point, and I'm sure he wasn't a stranger to these feelings.
Stephen arranged for Jalik to receive respite care in the home of Elaine and Tom Persons, who provided respite care when Jalik was being fostered by Larry and Jody Shun. Stephen hadn't met Tom or Elaine, or even talked to them. He just had their number for when Jalik first came to live with them as a foster. I'm not really going to hold that against Stephen. Larry and Jody were licensed foster care providers, and Stephen was, if nothing else, desperate at this point. Jalik stayed with Tom and Elaine for a period of 6 days, and they would have kept him longer, but they had an out-of-town engagement. Jalik was returned to Stephen at 6:45 p.m. on November 1st, 2007. Stephen planned on sending Jalik back to another respite care provider the very next day. On the way home, Stephen took Jalik to a Red Robin restaurant in Lantham, New York, where he was seen by a manager and waitstaff eating dinner around 8 p.m., Stephen said he then took Jalique to his parents' home. I'm guessing Jalique was no longer welcome in the family home, and that is why Stephen took him to his parents' home, which was in the 10 block of Hell Street in Greenwich, New York. There are reports that an argument ensued during the ride home when Stephen told Jalique he had to write a letter to the child he'd allegedly threatened. According to Stephen and Jocelyn, Jalique was both homicidal and suicidal on this evening.
First of all, the social workers never stepped in. They knew Stephen had put Jalique in respite care, the family wanted a reverse adoption, and Jalique's emotional state was at crisis level. All the adults in Jalique's life up to this point had failed him. I mean, the bare minimum, Stephen should have taken him to the emergency room, nothing else. They were getting compensated for Jalique's care, so I'm sure an emergency room visit couldn't have hurt that much.
Despite his alleged state of mind, Stephen reported that he and Jalique watched a movie and fell asleep once they arrived at Stephen's parents' house. Stephen reported that he woke up at 7:30 a.m. on November 2nd, 2007, to a note written by Jalique that said, in part, I quote, "Dear everybody, I'm sorry for everything. I won't be a bother anymore. Goodbye, Jalique," unquote. He also left a sheet of paper with the word Albany scrawled in big letters. An hour and 27 minutes after Stephen allegedly discovered the notes, he reported Jalique as a runaway to the Greenwich Police Department.
"You claim you love this little boy, and you wake up to a note written by a child that you claim to be homicidal and suicidal, and you wait an hour and a half before you call the authorities? It just doesn't sit well. I hope Stephen has a good explanation for waiting an hour and a half. In modern times, with cell phones, he could have called the police while he was searching."
We couldn't find any reports that there were extensive searches done the day that Jalique disappeared, so we assume that the police regarded him as a runaway. Stephen and Jocelyn certainly carried on as if there was nothing wrong. Stephen went to his boss's birthday party the next day, and Jocelyn went to a doctor's appointment. 2 days after the disappearance, Greenwich and Cambridge police joined with forest rangers and other law enforcement officials to search the area for Jalique. They dredged a pond, conducted shoulder-to-shoulder grid searches, and used dogs. They searched extensively and found absolutely no trace of Jalique. Within a few days, authorities suspect foul play. 10 days after the search, the Greenwich police chief said, and I quote, "In 30 years, a kid of 12 years old, and I don't care what mindset he is, doesn't fall off the face of the world. We don't just have a runaway kid here."
I'm glad the police quickly came to that conclusion. I mean, Jalique's race alone in that area, someone would have spotted him. I mean, a 12-year-old in New York during the winter, 10 days in the wild, it just doesn't add up.
Jalique's birth mother came forward to provide DNA to law enforcement in the event his remains were found. Police immediately focused their attention on Stephen and Jocelyn and asked them to take polygraph tests. Jocelyn takes one, but Stephen refuses. "I'm assuming Jocelyn passed. I didn't see any indication that she failed, but I also didn't find any indication she was ruled out as a suspect." Stephen and Jocelyn's behavior is just bizarre after this point. The police asked for permission to search Stephen's parents' house where Jalique allegedly slept the night before his disappearance, but Stephen declined, saying he was too busy to meet police there. By November 6, 2007, the parents have stopped cooperating with the police and are no longer looking for Jalique. In fact, there are reports that a neighbor called Jocelyn to offer to help with the search, and Jocelyn said, "That's ridiculous. Go if you want, but I'm not." There are also reports that Stephen and Jocelyn were ripping down missing posters. Stephen and Jocelyn retained an attorney on November 7th, 2007, 5 days after their son disappeared. Stephen and Jocelyn attend Jalique's vigil, where Stephen sells eggs and rambles on about Martin Luther King Jr., saying that, and I quote, "The African Americans at that time had been given a bad check, had been given a check that said insufficient funds. And when Jalique Rainwalker was born, he was given that same check," end quote. I encourage listeners to get onto YouTube and find the interviews conducted with Stephen and Jocelyn during this time. Their behavior is hard to explain. The vigil was the last time they held anything for Jalique or participated in any way in the search for their son. Bizarrely, Stephen and Jocelyn maintained that he ran away and was living with a gang or an African-American family because he'd always wanted to live with an African-American family. They also decreased the reward available for information about Jalique's whereabouts. Stephen and Jocelyn originally offered a $25,000 reward for information, but that amount was dropped to $5,000 and was lowered each month after that until there was no reward. In January 2008, about 2 months after Jalique disappeared, police named Stephen a person of interest in the case. Stephen's cell phone records indicate that he did not take the route home from Red Robin to his parents' house that he had initially claimed. Additionally, Stephen received a phone call at 8:15 p.m. that evening and said that he was on Route 40 in the hamlet of Melrose in the town of Shattuckoke. Listeners, please forgive me for that. But cell phone records indicated that he was in South Troy, nowhere near where he said he was. The person who spoke with Stephen during that 8:15 p.m. phone call said that Stephen was agitated. More concerning, police allegedly told Jalique's maternal grandmother, Barbara Reilly, that the cell phone pinged in an area near the Hudson River that is notorious for dumping bodies. No one reports to the police that they saw Jalique walking away from the home that night. And Tom and Elaine, the couple who provided respite care prior to his disappearance, weighed in about the note Stephen allegedly found. They said Stephen assigned the note to Jalique as homework when he was staying with them. Stephen wanted Jalique to apologize to the child he'd threatened, and Tom claimed he saw Jalique writing a letter, which he believes was the note Stephen assigned as homework, and then claimed it was a runaway note. Investigators also uncovered an image from the Glen Falls National Bank in Greenwich of a van that looks like the one Stephen was driving the night Jalique disappeared. The discovery of the video prompted the police to say that the video hurt Stephen's credibility. The likelihood of a van, the same color and same make and model as Stephen's, being out in the middle of the night were slim. However, no arrest was made. The footage was recorded at 12:16 a.m., when Stephen claimed he and Jalique were sleeping. Around the same time, police investigated a letter sent to some media outlets claiming Jalique was alive and well. It read, and I quote, "Jalique still alive, needed a foot soldier for this war on drugs. Picked him up Route 40, post 30. He's okay. No fake. He says, ask his mama and papa who are the Macaroni family. My cat named Diamond? Why does Frenti yell fire? Don't look, we are not there," end quote. The information in the letter was something that only someone close to the family could have known, and there was much speculation at the time that the letter was written by Stephen and Jocelyn. Elaine said she doubted the letter was written by Jalique, as Jalique was extremely intelligent and would not have written a letter that shifted from third person to first person. Then, in February 2008, the police get a warrant to search Stephen's parents' house. They seized a computer, presumably to see if the letter was written on it. However, the search did not lead to an arrest. Just days after the search, Stephen and Jocelyn filed suit against the police department, alleging they'd been illegally detained and that the search was improper. It's around the same time that Stephen moves his family to West Rupert, Vermont, where they told neighbors they were a family of six and not a family of seven with a missing son. In July 2008, Barbara Reilly, Jalique's maternal grandmother, burglarized Stephen and Jocelyn's home in New York. Stephen and Jocelyn had moved to Vermont by this time, so the house was vacant. Barbara reportedly saw the yellow fleece Jalique was wearing the night he disappeared, and this prompted police to search the property again the next day. The police recovered the yellow fleece jacket at that time. Barbara had no police record, and police believe she broke into the house to find clues in Jalique's case. She was released on her own recognizance and pled not guilty. Barbara has been vocal about her son-in-law's history and behavior. She told the media that Stephen had anger management issues that required counseling, and that Jocelyn kicked him out of the home twice in 2007 for aggressive behavior towards the children. She also reported that she witnessed Stephen dragging Jalique outside and dunking him in a creek. Barbara also claimed that after Jalique's disappearance, Stephen referred to Jalique as evil. Barbara petitioned the court after Jalik's disappearance to get full custody of him so that she could open any and all records of Jalik's to law enforcement. Unfortunately, the judge had no precedence to award her custody and declined to do so. Barbara also advocated for Jalik's law, which called for the state's Office of Children and Family Services to monitor hard-to-adopt children even after their adoption. Unfortunately, we can't find any evidence that the law came to fruition. Stephen has maintained his innocence. He still does not cooperate with police, and neither he nor Jocelyn call the police department for updates on the case. One of the few times Stephen spoke to the press in the weeks after Jalik's disappearance, he said, and I quote, "I was not involved in his disappearance. I have nothing to hide. Every person we've talked to outside of the police believe he's alive," end quote. Jocelyn echoed her husband's sentiments and told reporters she was hopeful that Jalik hitched a ride to New York or Vermont or to Albany, New York, where he had ties. Jocelyn went on to say that he had many reasons to go many places and that he could have gone just about anywhere. But she also said that Jalik was troubled and hurting. She said, and I quote, "I'm very, very afraid as time goes on. We need to let everybody know this is a little boy who may be afraid or embarrassed to come home because of all the media attention. I love him so much. I just want him to be safe and to know where he is and that he is safe," end quote. There were some reported sightings of Jalik after his disappearance, but none of them panned out. One child spotted in Albany looked so much like Jalik, the police took the time to determine his birth lineage in order to rule him out as being Jalik. The child was stopped so often by law enforcement and other people believing him to be Jalik, he took to carrying a letter that stated he was not Jalik Rainwalker. The resemblance is really uncanny, so I suggest you Google it. Jalik has a doppelganger for sure. The investigation reached another dead end when a man claimed he'd been kidnapped and beaten and that his assailant showed him Jalik's missing poster and a picture of a body they said was Jalik's. They claimed that they killed Jalik and that the man would be next if he did not settle his drug debt. However, law enforcement ruled that the body in the photo was not Jalik. In 2012, the police reclassified Jalik's case from a missing persons case to a probable child homicide. They took cadaver dogs to a property in Troy shortly before the announcement was made, but found nothing. Police asked the media to stop sharing age-progressed photos of Jalik, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children agreed to take those photos off their website. Reclassification of a missing persons case to a homicide case sometimes encourages police to use more resources. Police stated that they ruled out most of the people they would consider suspects and that Stephen Kerr remained the only person of interest in the case. In March 2017, a skull was found near the Hudson River south of Albany, and the discovery raised hopes that Jalik could finally be brought home. But it was not Jalik. Instead, it was an unidentified male between the ages of 20 and 50. I know we both have suspicions about what actually happened to Jalik that night. Let's discuss each of the possible scenarios: runaway, suicide, or foul play. Let's talk about the suicide scenario first. What are your thoughts, Travis?
I don't think anyone, to include the police, thinks the suicide theory is valid. I mean, by what means did Jalik have to do it? There's no evidence of weapons. And where's his remains? I mean, Jalik couldn't kill himself and then hide himself. So suicide theory for me is out.
I agree. I don't think it makes sense at all. The next theory is the runaway theory, and the only reason we're discussing it is because Stephen and Jocelyn seem married to the idea that he left to go live with a gang or went to New York or some other story. What do you think about the runaway theory?
Where's a 12-year-old going to run to in New York during the winter? I mean, this is absurd, to be honest. Jalik, again, is 12. No one spotted him since, and it was obvious people were looking for him because they had a kid that was stopped so many times he needed a letter to say he wasn't Jalik. Who's assisting Jalik? It just doesn't make sense unless there's someone out there that had contact with Jalik or someone from maybe his biological family who kept in contact with them. But none of these seem to be realistic. So, again, that's out for me as well.
Yeah, and I don't know how they would keep in contact with him. They certainly don't seem to be living in a situation where internet access was abundant. I suppose one thing that could have happened is that he ran away and met a stranger and that he was then met with foul play at that point. What do you think?
I think that's the odds of that happening is like the odds of you getting struck by lightning. Again, that doesn't work for me either.
I think what's most likely is what makes the most sense, and that's that Steven was responsible for Jalik's disappearance. Do you agree?
Definitely. I mean, Steven was the last person with them, so statistically, it's most likely that he did it. The waiter saw him at Red Robin that night together, so, you know, Steven can't lie about that one. Everyone knows that. Well, I won't say everyone, but there's witnesses that state he was together, and he's already been caught in lies, so I definitely think Steven did it.
So he's the last person to see him alive, and then they leave the restaurant. There's an 8:15 phone call where we know he was agitated. The caller says that. He tells the caller he's one place. Cell phone pings say he's in another place. So those two things are marks against Steven as well. Then the next morning he wakes up to an alleged suicide note or a note, a goodbye note that Tom and Elaine have said was written for different reasons. So that's another reason to call into question his credibility.
Not to mention a van of the same make model that Steven owns. I mean, the smoking gun's here. Obviously, it's Steven.
If that make and model van that they saw at the bank is Steven, it's another way he lied because he said he was asleep at 12:16. And there he is on camera, 12:16, in the middle of the night. What was he doing?
I think we all have a theory of what we think Steven was doing at 12:16 in the morning on the night Jalik disappeared. I just think it's peculiar that Steven takes Jalik to his parents' house where no one's allegedly there and no one has seen Jalik since.
And then his behavior after Jalik disappears doesn't help him out at all. He's selling eggs at the Vigil. He's allegedly ripping down missing persons posters. He stops cooperating with the police. I think these are all indicative of things that would tell you he has something to hide. The one thing I'm not sure of is what Jocelyn's role is in this disappearance.
For me, I think Jocelyn was part of the motivation. I mean, Steven had his wife pressuring him to do something with Jalik. He had the safety of his own kids that I'm sure he had in the back of his mind. So I think Jocelyn may not know exactly what Steven did. I think she knew once Steve and Jalik left that night, she'd never see Jalik again.
I do think she had enough information about Steven to believe that he had the capacity to be aggressive towards the children. We have reports that he was in the past. I still question, however, the extent of her knowledge. You know, is she holding on to the runaway theory because she really believes that might have happened and she trusts her husband? So I guess we can agree to disagree on that.
Okay, but we at least agree on the system failures, right?
I think there's little doubt that the system was a huge failure here, and they were at least somewhat responsible for his disappearance. They let Steven and Jocelyn adopt him when, in my opinion, their home wasn't ready for a child like Jalik. They didn't step in when they knew that Steven and Jocelyn wanted to reverse the adoption. They didn't step in when they knew Jalik was going back to respite care again. So I think the system failure was monumental here.
Oh, I agree the system failed them. But I wonder how many families out there are willing to take in a child like Jalik, you know, with all the emotional things he had going on and his mental health at the time. So again, I reiterate, I think the system failed him. The person working his case, or the people, shall I say, working his case, what other options did they have? Could they have placed him somewhere else? Were Steven and Jocelyn the last resort for Jalik? I mean, I just think, again, the adults in Jalik's life failed him horribly. And this system, our child care system as a whole, failed them.
I agree. And I will say that maybe they didn't have enough resources to conduct in-depth investigations as maybe they should have or could have. I do wish they would have followed up and made sure that Jalik was getting his medication and his therapy, and that doesn't seem like it happened. Let's talk about the police response. I feel like we're going to talk about that a lot with these cases. What do you think about the police response here?
I mean, as you know, it was kind of hard to find a timeline of exactly what the police did. I think after the days went on, the police did a little more, but initially, I'm not sure that they did everything they could have or should have done for Jalik. Ultimately, I hope that they gave Jalik the time and effort that he deserved, but I'm not sure. The jury for me is out on this one.
I question that as well, especially since Barbara felt compelled to essentially break into a home to get evidence. That makes me wonder about their level of participation in the case.
As a final thought for me, I often wonder, you know, since we started researching this case, where are the other kids that Stephen and Jocelyn are taking care of? Are they being checked on in Vermont? Is the police department following them, you know, just to touch bases to make sure Stephen and Jocelyn know what they did or what they're suspected of? I hope for the kids' sake in this situation that they are getting the attention that I'm led to believe Jalik didn't get.
Especially since there's that other adopted child with disabilities there. Hopefully they are paying special attention to that. And I would also hope that Stephen and Jocelyn are no longer viable candidates for fostering children or adopting them.
Jalik Rainwalker would be 22 years old today. He is a biracial male with green eyes and brown hair. He was last seen wearing a bright yellow fleece pullover, a gray shirt with a dragon on it, blue jeans, and canvas high tops. Foul play is suspected in his disappearance. If you have any information about what happened to Jalik or information about where Stephen Kerr was on November 1st and 2nd of 2007, please call Greenwich Valley Police Department at 518-692-9332. That's 518-692-9332. You can also call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-THE-LOST. If you're from New York, where Jalik is from, and you're struggling with a child in your custody, and you need help, you can call a Family Crisis Center at 1-888-435-7553. That's 1-888-435-7553.
We struggled with which facts to bring you this week. Did you need to know that Jalik had reactive attachment disorder? Did you need to know that he threatened a child before he disappeared? Ultimately, we decided that you needed to know that information to best understand the circumstances from which he went missing. However, those were mere moments in Jalik's life, weeks, short periods of time. They weren't who Jalik was as a person. We want to make sure you understand who he was before we end today. Jalik was a bright and caring boy. He loved apple picking with his granny. He loved getting ice cream and pizza. He loved animals and tarot cards. He loved going to granny camp during winter and summer breaks. The most telling anecdote I have about Jalik is that one time his grandmother asked him whether or not he wanted to live in the city or in the country when he grew up. Despite Jalik's life, he answered, "It didn't matter. I'll live wherever my wife wants to because I love her and I love our children so much that it won't matter where I live." Please join us next week as we discuss the case of Yasmin Akri and also the case of Ivan Ernesto Aguilar. This is the classical version of The Reckoning Song by Asaf Avidan.